You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest, Diane Lake, was 14 years old when she fell in with a bunch of hippies and their charismatic leader, an ex-con, aspiring singer-songwriter named Charles Manson. Her memoir has just been published, and it's called Member of the Family, My Story of Charles Manson, Life Inside His Cult, and the Darkness That Ended the 60s. Diane Lake, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
Well, in the short time since you've written and published your memoir, Charles Manson has died. How did you react when you heard that news?
I actually had a real sense of relief and sort of closure. And I hope that a lot of the families of victims also felt that.
Well, what made you decide to tell your story now? What prompted you 50 years later?
There were many reasons, but I needed the closure. I needed to find and face, you know, that skeleton in the closet that had hidden for so many years, because I realized there really wasn't anything that I needed to hide about it. And I really wanted to give credit and glory to God for getting me through that dark time.
Well, you really don't hold anything back in your book, drug use, sexual situations, whatever. How did you feel about facing all that?
Well, I knew that it was the truth, and I just, I was in therapy for grieving of my late husband who had died. And so then it just, you know, it all just kind of flowed together and flowed out. And, you know, I was able to reconcile who I was back then with the, you know, the adult, mature woman I am now.
When you discuss your family a lot in the book, and so I'm wondering, is your family still living, your brother, your sister, your parents?
My father has passed away, but my mother is still living, as well as my brother and sister. And my sister has read the book, and my mother is in the process of reading the book. So, and they're very supportive. There's hard parts in there. You know, I understand that, but I feel like it was the reality, and that's what a lot of people. I mean, when you put it against the context of today, or against the context of, you know, the 40s, it's unbelievable. But when you put it in the context of what was happening in the 60s, which was really what, you know, inspired my dad to follow into, you know, this communal acid-taking existence, was because of what was going on in the 60s with Timothy Leary, you know, expounding on, you know, the benefits of taking LSD. And just, it was just new thinking. People were fed up with the Vietnam War. And I think that really led to it all. But it's a cautionary tale because, you know, beware. Beware of things that seem too good to be true.
Well, you know, you and I are about the same age. And I remember being a kid in those days that parents were not quite as hovering as they are now, definitely not as hovering as they are now. And when we wanted to go trick-or-treating or whatever, I mean, they just let us go and do stuff and then...
Yeah, come back when the streetlights come on.
even if that. But, of course, my parents were... They probably would have objected if I had gone to live with a cult. So do you, when you think back on the situation that got you involved, do you, are you angry with your parents?
No. In some ways, you know, there is some disappointment, but we've discussed it and, you know, realized that I was the oldest, and I'd always been, you know, do it myself. I'd been very capable. And, you know, nowadays, I mean, it's just part of the process of being a teenager is that you want to be independent from your parents. It's part of the growing up process. And so since I was the firstborn and had always been very capable and, you know, we were embarking on this new set of rules to live by, I can see from their point how they could have let me go. When my children, especially my daughter, you know, was 13 and 14, I really had to, you know, question it. But it was a different, you know, it was a different time, and the whole Manson, you know, and all the commune, that already happened, and I knew very well what could happen, you know, in that kind of context. So, it's been a process to reconcile it all, for sure. But I'm glad I did. I'm glad I embarked on the journey, and I really felt like God had opened up a lot of doors, even especially to the point of helping me find Deb Herman, who is my co-author. She was had been a trial attorney and had also had a degree in journalism specializing in memoirs and true crime. And on top of all that, she was a 60s buff. Anything that happened in the, I mean, you know, she collected games from the 60s and movies and TV shows and books about the TV shows in the 60s. She was really into the 60s. So she was just like the perfect, she was just the perfect person to write my story.
And how did she contribute to your story? I mean, did you, you talked it into a tape recorder, you wrote a first draft? How did your collaboration work?
I wrote down my memories. I got a life coach, and I wrote down my memories in as much chronological order as I could. And then when I got with Deb, she interviewed me and recorded it, and, you know, and we just kept that up. I mean, she came out here to California. We went to the Barker Ranch. You know, we went to some of the Spawn Ranch. We went to some of the different sites. And she just kept circling in, made a wide circle, and then the circle just kept getting tighter and tighter, and, you know, my memories were triggered, and what I was able to remember and what I was able to feel got much deeper.
Tell us a little bit about when you first got involved, how you met the family, and maybe the first time that you met Charles Manson.
The first time I met Charles Manson, I was going to the Spiral Staircase house with some friends, and I had lived at the Spiral Staircase house before, but now, you know, this guy and his girls, and I really didn't know who was living there then. I just was going with some friends, and there was, you know, they had suggested that I meet this person and, you know, and this little commune, this little family of people. And so when I walked in the door, everybody knew me. The girls, two of the girls, I think it was Lynette and Patty, ran up, Diane is here. And I was just flabbergasted because I had no idea that I didn't know these people, and I didn't know that they knew me or knew of me. It wasn't until later I found out that they had actually visited the hog farm commune where my parents were living and actually had gone on a little excursion out into the desert with my parents and my brother and sister. And I was in San Francisco at the time, and my mother gave Charlie my picture so that when they went to San Francisco, if they ran into me, they would know who I was.
Was that flattering that they all knew who you were?
Oh my gosh, it was magical. And, you know, that was probably one of the strongest emotions, and I had just come from living for a few weeks at the hog farm where I was kind of considered jailbait. And so I didn't feel welcome there. And because I'd been on my own for a few months, my parents weren't, like, jumping in to enfold me. I was just, like, another entity, another, you know, person who came into this commune. And they, you know, so I was their daughter, but they weren't, at that point, I was no longer really part of the nuclear family.
So Charles Manson saw some things in you that he was able to capitalize on to kind of cement your relationship. What were those things?
Well, I mean, I think he saw me as a, you know, a young, more or less disenfranchised girl. Or young, you know, a young woman. And all of the girls, even at that time, you know, most of them had been sort of disenfranchised from their parents. And so I think we were just that much easier to, you know, manipulate because we were needy. You know, we had wants and desires, or and we all wanted to belong. And he made that feeling very strong of feeling like we belong together.
Now, as your relationship with Manson progresses in your book, Member of the Family, it gets very unpleasant. But the beginning of it was very pleasant. You liked him a lot.
I did. And I liked being with the girls.
Which was the thing that, what was luring you in more, being with the other girls or being with Charles?
I think it was both. It was a commune, which, you know, my parents had embarked on and had embraced. And it seemed like that's what was happening in the world, that this was a new way of thinking, a new way of living, and I didn't belong in the one that my parents had chosen, so I felt really, you know, desired, and I was sexually active, and Charlie made me feel very, you know, loved and lovely.
Had you already been taking LSD and using drugs before you got in with the cult?
Yes.
What was your early experiences with LSD?
My first experience with LSD was actually in my own living room before we dropped out. My dad had, you know, offered it, and I took it with my two best friends in my living room, and we listened to Beatles songs, and we read the Timothy Leary's Tibetan Book of the Dead. And it was very pleasant. I mean, it was, you know, it was fun. I did have the experience of a cable, though a connection with my parents was severed that night.
Really? You became your own person that night?
Yeah. I just remember even almost the visual of this cable between, you know, like an adult kind of umbilical cord. I mean, just really like I thought of it as a cable that I was connected to my parents and that had been severed, and it wasn't a bad thing. I didn't even think of it as a bad thing. It was just like I disconnected. I became, you know, my own. I wasn't just their daughter. I was Diane, my own person.
Is it hard for you to look back at in this and find as many? I mean, I'm sure there were good things, lots of good things. Can you still find those good things, or does it all seem like a terrible ordeal, or what?
No, I still remember, you know, the good things that kept me hanging on. And even, you know, and I did have some bad trips, but most of the time taking LSD was, I remember it as being a good thing, you know, or an enjoyable thing, watching the world be alive, you know, watching trees grow, and I mean, all the colors and all the, I mean, it just made you feel very much one with the world. And so that was very special. I did have some bad trips, though, and I know that I had disobeyed Charlie and had come back down from Barker Ranch in Death Valley, and he was extremely unhappy with me and said, I'm going to find your parents. I'm taking you back to your parents. And he did find them, and I did go back with them for, you know, a few days. But I just, at that point, I think I was so deeply programmed into Charlie-ism that I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere else. And even though he basically was rejecting me and he didn't want me, you know, to be around anymore, I was like a fish out of water. I couldn't function.
When you had your own children, did you discuss drugs with them and drug use?
Yes.
And, you know, what did you say? Let's take acid together? No, you didn't say that.
No, I didn't. But on the other hand, I did, you know, steer them away, you know, but I also know that if you steer them away in a fearful way, that the first opportunity, they're going to try it. So both my husband and I, you know, had smoked marijuana and taken LSD in our lives, or, you know, some sort of a psychedelic, you know, magic mushrooms or psilocybin. And so, you know, we just cautioned them. This is not, you know, this is not a good drug, but because it accentuates how you're feeling. I mean, if you're feeling good, it's probably going to be good. But if you're feeling bad about yourself, it's going to be, you know, it's going to make it twice as bad or five times as bad if you're feeling bad about yourself. And, you know, people can't be trusted. You don't know why are they offering you this drug?
Oh, well, you know, you certainly learned that people could not be trusted.
Right, and people do not always seem, you know, they don't always appear the way they are. And so I think, you know, we weren't helicopter parents. We weren't hovering, but we were a little more, you know, a little more cautious, a little bit more aware how things can go. And I think that, I mean, one example of that is that one of my sons had taken, like, I think magic mushrooms, and he was having a scary trip. He came home, and I was able to, you know, wrap him in a blanket and hold him, and we looked up the side effects, you know, on the internet together. And this was before he knew about my past. But I didn't totally freak out because of it. You know, it's just like, okay, you know, we're going to get through this. And, you know, just gave him some reassurance, you know, and enfolded him and got him through. And he's, you know, he's looked back on that and told me, gosh, I always wondered why you were so understanding. But on the other hand, I think as parents, we didn't knee-jerk when those sorts of events came up. And so they weren't afraid to tell us. And then I think that's the most important thing as parents of teenagers, is that you need to keep the lines of communication open, even if what they tell you is shocking or frightening. It's you just ride the wave with them. And you've got more control. You've got more influence over them in that respect than, you know, grounding them and, you know, just, I don't know, taking this really hard path. So in that respect, I think it was, you know, my drug use, and I never took what I call hard drugs. I mean, that's what young kids are up against today, and that's the opioids. I mean, it's deadly. I mean, where I live, we've had quite a few young people die from overdose of opioids. So it's that is very, that is very serious. Anyway, didn't mean to go off on that bunny trail, but
no, I'm glad you did.
No, it is, as you know, it is important, and I think that that's a message that I like to convey to other parents of teenagers, is that it's, you know, they're trying to break away, they're trying to find who they are, and they want to be different from you. So, you know, you just kind of have to, you know, don't totally freak out if they want to get into the cowboy scene or into the, you know, alternative music scene or whatever the different scenes are out there. I mean, you don't want them to go, you don't want them to get into, you know, hard drugs.
On the other hand, if they want to join a cult,
no, yeah, no, that is just like, you know, you don't want them to get separated from you. I mean, you, as young adult, you want to help them. That's a huge transition. And I know very well that, you know, at 13 or 14, and I saw it in my own kids and everybody else's kids, 13 and 14 year olds think they know it all, you know, and that the parents are dumb as rocks. And, you know, it's just part of the process. So I, in that respect, you know, back, circling back around to one of the questions that you asked, is that, yeah, that's what I don't hold against my parents. You know, there was a time when I wanted my dad to, like, rescue me, and, you know, we talked about it. My dad said that he wanted to rescue me, but he was afraid that, you know, by rescuing me, or whatever his idea of rescue was, that was just going to push me farther into Charlie's grasp. So he didn't. So he withheld. And anyway, so we've talked about it, and we had resolution before he died.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. My guest tonight is Diane Lake. At age 14, she became a member of the Charles Manson family. At age 17, she helped put him in prison, and she's just written a book. It's called Member of the Family: My Story of Charles Manson, Life Inside His Cult, and the Darkness That Ended the 60s. There's so many adventures, and they're some of them sound kind of fun, like when you were hanging out with Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys and living in his home. And
yeah, no, it was, you know, that was, the house and the grounds were fabulous, and, you know, there were all kinds of bands coming over and playing, and, you know, Charlie was super happy, and it wasn't the whole family. I think that's what a lot of people don't understand, that it was really just a few of us girls, and a few more people became members of the family during that time. But, you know, half of the girls and family had gone up further north, up into Mendocino. So it wasn't like the whole family moved in on Dennis Wilson. And it was my perception that he enjoyed having us. He was proud to show off Charlie, and he thought it was, he was amazed at the kind of meals that we could put together after shopping in the bins at the back of the grocery store. You know, and we, you know, we did. We made use of things that people threw away. And that's, you know, Charlie used to think of us that way, too, you know, is that he was making use of, you know, us girls that had been thrown away by our parents, or, you know, there was a certain aspect of that kind of thinking. But he was a con, you know, and he had an incredible magnetism, and he had this way of being whoever anybody needed. And, you know, he'd been in reform school and in prison and, you know, basically educated by pimps and, you know, musicians, and he just had this charisma. I mean, I know a lot of the pictures, you know, don't, it's hard to explain, but we were taken advantage of, there's no doubt about it. But when I, you know, like, he's right now, my son, my oldest son, is older than Charlie was when I met him. And I don't, you know, I've been thinking about that. It's like, he just, you know, he doesn't, my son doesn't seem that old.
Yeah. And Charlie seemed like a father figure at the time.
Well, a little bit of a father figure, but also, you know, he was a lover.
Right.
You know, I think when I met him, he was, what, 32? You know, and my son is now, my oldest is 34. And, you know, I just see him as his life is, he's just getting it together.
Did you know all those things about Charles Manson at the time, that he had been in prison and all of that?
I knew he'd been in prison fairly early on, but it seemed like petty stuff. You know, it was like forgery and that's pretty much all I remember. It wasn't until later that the whole, I think he had been arrested or whatever for transporting a woman or over state lines, or, you know, had something to do with prostitution. So, but, you know, it wasn't like murder and mayhem. You know, it wasn't those kinds of things. So I don't know. Half of my brain thinks back to, you know, how I felt about him when I was 14, and then the other half of my brain thinks about him, you know, as a mature woman who really had been at that point when I was a child, you know, really had been abused. And he did rape me. He did, you know, abuse me. And as far as the law goes, yes, I mean, every sexual encounter was statutory rape. But most of the time it was consensual. So I didn't, you know, so it's really... And that's one of the things that's been really good about writing the book, is it really helped me see that I was a victim, that I was, you know, under his control to a great extent. And fortunately, he didn't trust me, didn't ask, you know, or what, for whatever reason, thanks be to God, that he didn't ask me to do any killing.
Do you think you would have participated in it if he'd asked you?
No, I don't. I don't think I was capable. I don't know how the other girls were capable.
When you first learned of the killings, were you shocked? Were you like, oh, now it makes sense? Or what was your initial reaction?
No, I was shocked. I mean, it's like my whole world, you know, like the rug had been pulled out from underneath me. These are people that, you know, that I had loved and spent time with and I the whole helter skelter thing was real, but it was something that we were going to be running from, that we were going to be, you know, that we were looking for safety from, not something that we were going to perpetuate or to perpetrate or, you know, start. That was not that was not really what I was thinking Helter Skelter was about. So when I found out that, you know, from text that he had committed these murders at Charlie's request, I was terrified to run, because at that point it was like, I need to get out of here. But I was afraid. Then I was really afraid. Here, this is a man who is bragging, basically, about killing people in a horrible way.
And he had, in fact, threatened to kill you, right?
Charlie had. But when Tex was the first one that told me.
He was the one who was bragging about it, you're saying?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then the girls, you know, later on, you know, a week or two later, up in the desert, they were like, you know, they were kind of bragging about it, too. They were kind of gleeful in their, you know, recounting this murderous, you know, account.
They told you details?
Yeah.
Well, that must have flipped you out, to say the least.
Yeah, and the desert, I mean, Death Valley, where Barker Ranch is extremely remote. I mean, it's, two girls did run away and escape, which is, wow, amazing. And Charlie had us beat in the bushes for those girls, and I really think that if they had been found, that he would have killed them, or someone. He would have had someone kill them. He was very upset. But it, just to get to the base of Goler Wash is quite remote. And then getting up the wash to Barker Ranch is about, you know, 4 hours of moving rocks and taking jeeps up over, you know, rutted, rocky roads.
Well, in subsequent years, after you had testified and helped to send Manson to prison, after, say, you know, when Squeaky Fromm tried to kill President Ford, did you fear for your life then? Did you think that there were still Manson family members who might come after you?
Yes, it did. Yeah, it crossed my mind. And so I kept what I thought of as a low profile. I mean, I didn't move out of the state, but I was careful, and that's, you know, part of the reason I didn't tell anybody.
Well, obviously you knew Lynette Fromm. Were you surprised when she tried to kill President Ford?
Yeah. And then they had some kind of a hit list. That was really disconcerting. I mean, it still is. It still is.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been in contact with any of the imprisoned Manson family members?
No. No. And even other than Barbara Hoyt, I have never spoken to any of the other former members that got out.
In the subsequent years since you were involved in the Manson family, there have been, you know, about 75 books and several films and novels and so forth. Have you seen them? Have you read them? Or do you avoid them? How do you feel about them?
Oh, I had no idea. I had no idea how there were as many books as there are out there until I wrote mine. Although one of the reasons that I started to write mine is that I had encountered a blog a Manson blog, and actually one of he's gone now, Bill Nelson, had contacted me, and he filled me in on a number of whereabouts of different family members and what they were up to quite a few years ago now. But there were, I came to know about this one blog because she stole a picture off my Facebook of me reading to my granddaughter. And somebody alerted me to that, and I went on the blog, and I asked her to please take that picture down, and I gave her another picture, you know, to replace it with, because it just was infuriating.
You didn't want your granddaughter's picture up there.
Yeah. But what I found out was that there were movie scripts being written for a movie that was really based on my perspective without ever contacting me. So I contacted an intellectual property attorney and found out there was nothing I could do about, you know, preserve. I mean, I couldn't stop it because they could write whatever they wanted based on public information.
What about the novel The Girls? Are you familiar with Emma Klein's novel The Girls?
I'm familiar with the fact that it was, you know, written, but I have not read it. And really, the only books that I read Helter Skelter way back when Bugliosi, you know, wrote it. And then I read another book by Ed Sanders, The Family. And until I was writing my own book, I did not read. I read some excerpts from other people's books in our process of researching, but I have not read any other books in their entirety. And I'm just amazed at how many books are out there and how much commentary there is.
Mm. Yeah, well, of course, the Emma Klein book is kind of very similar to your story.
I've had people tell me that. You know, that there's a lot of... In fact, someone recently asked me, oh, well, did she, you know, did you talk to her? Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, another good reason for me to have written my own book, because those are my stories. You know, how I got my nickname and my, you know, how I joined the family and all of that. I mean, there's a lot of information out there that's just wrong.
You're listening to KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and the program is From the Bookshelf. My guest this week is Diane Lake. When she was 14, she joined the Manson family. When she was 17, she helped put him in prison. She's just written a memoir. It's called Member of the Family, My Story of Charles Manson, Life Inside His Cult, and the Darkness That Ended the 60s. Some of the Manson nicknames, you know, like Squeaky, you know, they're kind of cute. Your nickname, not so cute.
Not so cute, I know. It's kind of an embarrassment. But I basically, you know, well, you read my book, so you know how I, you know, it was really my own doing that gave me the nickname.
Well, we have to tell our listeners that you were known as Snake.
Yes. And it was because I had imagined, you know, I had just imagined what it would be like. I didn't think I was even high. I was just imagining, it was a hot day, and I was just imagining what it would be like to slither through the tall grass like a snake. You know, it wasn't even a rattlesnake. It was just a snake, you know, and then related the story to the girls and from then on. And that was early on. That was very early on in the process. So,
oh, I have another question about your life now. When you listen to music, especially the Beatles, I mean, the Beatles are a special place for me. I love the Beatles. I love the White Album, you know, so much. But when you hear it, does it have do you ever listen to that music? Do you have different?
The only songs that really I sort of avoid or I don't enjoy hearing are the ones on the White Album.
Right. Are you still a Beatles fan then?
Oh, yeah.
You and I were at the same Beatles concert, by the way, in 1966 at Dodger Stadium.
Yeah.
I remember I saw you there.
Right, in the nosebleed section.
Yeah. But you still enjoy listening to that kind of music, or do you listen to music much?
You know, actually, I'm a country music fan.
Uh-huh. Good.
I love Garth Brooks and, you know, Trisha Yearwood. But I like jazz, too. I like, you know, and I sing in a community chorus, and so I do a lot of, you know, Broadway musical songs, and I sing in the church choir, and so I sing Christian songs. I like to listen to Christian music. I like opera, you know. I like all kinds of music. And I like the old stuff. I like the old classic rock, you know, Creedence Clearwater and, you know, Bob Dylan. And
do you ever listen to that Beach Boys album that has 20, I think it's 2020, isn't it? The one that has the Charles Manson song?
I forgot. You know, I never really was a big Beach Boys fan. I you know, because I was born and raised in Minnesota, and we really hadn't been in California that long. So, you know, when I first moved here, I did not embrace California culture. I hated avocados. Palm trees were just disgusting, and Christmas just wasn't the same without snow. And so really, we moved out here to California in 65. So it really wasn't that many, you know, years later, 2 years later. After we moved here is when we dropped out.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the wonderful sections of your book is that early period when you're in California and you have friends and you're just a normal girl and you went to the Beatles concert. And it's so sad of what, you know, kind of losing your childhood before it's time.
Yeah, yeah. And my two best friends, you know, we talked about it since, and I was like, oh, we would have taken you in, you know, but it's just we didn't have the maturity really to think about that. And I was trying to fit in, and I didn't really know exactly where they lived, because they had moved, you know, several times when things got bad, you know. And that was my friends that found me in Topanga Canyon when Charlie and I ran up to him, and then Charlie, you know, said get in the truck, you know, and, you know, really made me feel bad for reaching out, and they were looking for me.
They had actually come to where you guys were hanging out to find you.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, you know, had I been more mature, or if it had, he just had obviously, you know, was under his thumb, you know, under his manipulation, or I would have just said, you know, forget it. I'm going with my friends. So that really makes me realize that I was afraid of him. You know, I was afraid of him, and I wanted to please him, kind of both. And that's how cult leaders, you know, they separate you from your family. They separate you from your friends, your former life, your former way of thinking, and they just kind of insulate you. He told me he didn't want me to get my picture taken, and, you know, part of that was probably because I was the youngest and underage, and so he didn't want me to get my picture taken. He didn't want me, you know, if we went somewhere in the car, I wasn't supposed to look out the window, and I just, you know, I tried to be obedient. But I wasn't always. I just bought this new T-shirt because I'm going to be 65 pretty soon. And it's, you know, February 1953. Classy and sassy and a little bit smart-assy. It's an age tea, you know, and but I just love it. And I mean, I think that really, you know, I think I always was a little smart smart alecky, whatever, you know. And I didn't always pay attention, you know. So I think I was fortunate in that way, but unfortunate in other ways. But I was so fortunate to have gotten out of that, to have been, you know, sent to a mental hospital and protected there for 9 months, and then, you know, taken in as a foster child of one of the arresting officers. I mean, that gave me my self-esteem back, protected me. I was able to, you know, testify, you know, where I felt really protected. And he saw something worth saving in me. And he brought me into his family with two younger kids, you know, a teenage girl and a little bit younger boy. I mean, that really is amazing when I think back, you know, that was really brave of him, or that he really saw something in me. And so, and then after that, another person invited me to come, you know, spend time with them in Spokane, and we ended up going to Europe. And so, you know, that I always thought of that summer in Spokane as the summer of recharging my batteries, because I was totally taken out of the LA scene, taken away from any possibility of, you know, Manson family members finding me, and just I just remember sleeping and sleeping and sleeping. I mean, I just slept for hours in the daytime and rode my bike. And it was just, and I just praise God. Thank you, God, for giving me that, all of those experiences. 9 months in the hospital with all these nurturing nurses and technicians and doctors, and then no drugs and no, really very little exposure to, you know, the outside world, and then being in a very small town, and then I did 2 semesters of junior college, and then I went to Spokane, and then I went to Europe, and I was in Europe for 2.5 years, and then came back. And so, you know, then I was able to, you know, really like start over there. And now I have, I have a master's degree and a teaching credential for moderate severe special education. I've been really, you know, I had a wonderful marriage to a wonderful man, loved me in spite of my past, and, you know, for 35 years, and 3 wonderful children. I've really been blessed.
Well, there are, dozens of books about Charles Manson and the Manson family, but there's never been one like this one. Member of the Family, My Story of Charles Manson, Inside His Cult, and the Darkness That Ended the 60s, written by my guest, Diane Lake. Diane Lake, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
You're welcome.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will join us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Diane Lake. Her new book is called Member of the Family, My Story of Charles Manson, Life Inside His Cult, and the Darkness That Ended the 60s. From the Bookshelf is produced by Ollie Jackson and Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks so much for joining me.